What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We have a lot of videos of the podcast and various other tutorials on YouTube. You can subscribe to our channel at mixingmusicpodcast.com/YouTube. Happy mixing and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I am your host, DK, and with me is...
Come on, I texted it to you. It was a great idea.
Hold on. You gave me like three ideas.
No, we already used that one. Or...
But it was another one. We might have to start over.
Was it Lua Deepa?
That's hot.
Dua Lupa.
Dua Lupa?
Can we do that one?
Or Lua...
Dua Lulu.
Hakalui?
Hakalui.
Hakalugi.
Hakalugi. I'll start over. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Dua Lupa. and if you're watching right now...
I put on a good show, then. I'm a great performer.
And if you're watching right now on the live stream, we are live on Twitch and on YouTube. You can go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/live to check that out if you're interested in that. But we are here right now with a very special guest came all the way out to the LA from Melbourne, Australia, specifically for this moment and for nothing else, for nobody else, just for here.
Nam just happened to be happening.
And, we got Nick from Panorama Mastering. Hello,
yeah.
Nick.
Thanks for paying for all the flights and the accommodation. Yeah. It's been such a good time to get flown out for this podcast.
Did you enjoy the sushi we sent to your room?
Yeah, $80. It was like, yeah. It was huge. It was awesome.
My
God. Nice.
No, just kidding. Nick has been out. We just finished up NAMM. So if you're watching right now or listening, if you're watching live, we literally just finished NAMM this weekend, hence why my voice is kind of shot and gone. But we just had 3 days of NAMM. Nick was out for that and is also out here visiting a bunch of other engineers and producers, just doing a lot of networking, doing a good job with all of that. But Nick has a wonderful YouTube channel called Panorama Mastering, and it's actually really great. In fact, you told me a story where even Baines recognized you and for your channel and has watched some of your videos. It's really great. You've had great business advice. I think... Was it a live stream or something? I don't remember, but in one of the, or maybe it was an interview on a podcast, but when you were asked the question, how do you make more clients? How do you get more clients? You actually gave like a really nice answer that I really liked, although that has nothing to do with, but you're really, really good with like in-depth technical stuff from intermediate to advanced level stuff. So we're excited for Nick to be here. Go subscribe to Panorama Mastering. But today the topic is compression. Specifically, what the hell are microdynamics and macrodynamics, and how can you utilize them to have better mixes, better sounding tracks? So let's start it up. what the hell are microdynamics and macrodynamics, Nick?
Okay, so the concept of microdynamics and macrodynamics, originally I saw documented from Bob Katz in his book on mastering. So microdynamics being the difference between various notes in a passage, and macrodynamics being the difference in volumes between passages within a piece of music. And how we approach that in our mastering approach and respect that, and how it actually affects our output and the listener's experience.
That's so interesting. I think if you've been listening to the podcast, Braden, who's the host of the exclusive content, you can sign up, mixmusicpodcast.com/exclusive for 3 times the amount of episodes as normal. We were talking about this, especially for me as a mixer, mix bus, where it's like I got really slow compression, more meant for like chorus to verse kind of dynamics versus transients.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's what you're talking about.
Yep. The difference in the way you approach that, whether it is with a compressor or automation or upward compression, a whole various.
So for the people on the audience, what is upward compression? Let's go there because you mentioned that real quick. Yep. What is upward compression?
Literally, it's parallel compression, but the verbiage is a little bit different just because we want to be a little bit fancier, but it sort of describes the process of what we're doing. So we're taking a parallel signal, we're compressing it really hard so we lose all the transient information, but we retain all the low-level detail information. So everything in the back of the mix gets retained, and then we blend that back up into it. So we're blending the low-level detail up into the mix. Moving upward compression.
And I like that a lot, to be honest. I do love upward or parallel compression a lot. One of my favorite plugins, I know y'all want us to talk about plugins, even though we don't care that much. One of our favorites is Baby Audio's iHeart New York, which is like a really simple VCA compression. And it's just like a volume knob. You blend the super wet signal in and it's just really nice. Mm-hmm. Single fader kind of thing. So tell us, how can a mixer or producer understand and utilize controlling or expanding or whatever microdynamics and macrodynamics in a mix or in a song?
Okay. So I'll start with macrodynamics. That's like a bigger picture. It's easy to incorporate. So macrodynamics, you're playing through sections of a song. You're just considering how loud something goes into the next thing and how you can manipulate the listener's perception of it. So we've seen tricks like this before, like in EDM tracks where over the 16 bars in the pre-chorus or the 8 bars before in the pre-chorus to the drop, you know, you can ride the fader down 1.5 decibels and then pop it straight back up as soon as the drop hits. Simple little things like that, but being conscious of how that interacts with the listener's experience. So that's where you can start in a big picture, just simply volume automation. Mm-hmm. Nothing crazy. You start there. Then when you go to the microdynamic detail, you know, it's really easy to appreciate that this in things like drums and, you know, pluck sort of synth sounds and little things that have, you know, both melodic and rhythmic information. How do you dial in your compressor? Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of space between the body and the transient? So you're going to have a little bit of a faster attack, or is it that, you know, you want a little bit more energy out of it, so you're going to use a little bit slower attack and just hold down the body so you can create a bit of separation there. So it's about listening appropriately and then making decisions based on how do you want to impact that listener with that information. And
nice.
Yeah.
Let me ask you how much, 'cause in mastering, I know a lot of people are kind of worried when they say, when a mastering engineer will say, oh, you know, I added a compressor. It's like, oh, he's changing my dynamics. He's changing my transients. How much do you find yourself shaping for that, but in use of compression on the masters? Like, I know the application we speak of right now is like more in the mix.
Yep.
But if they're applying this to the master, if they wanted to apply it in that sense, is there an application for that?
Yeah, there definitely is. It really depends on what autonomy you have over the project. So if you're producing yourself and you're finding yourself leaning heavily into the compressor to bring in some bounce or some glue to the mix, which otherwise you could be doing in the mix, it'd be like, don't bother using the compressor. You'll get much more cleaner results just going back into the mix to try get those levels right. Mm-hmm. In my position as a mastering engineer, I don't have that autonomy and agency. We get a stereo file, so we're going to listen to what's there. And then if things are poking out, sometimes it could be a snare drum that's poking out a bit hard. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, okay, well, how can we do that? Well, we use a high-pass sidechain filter so none of the low end sort of gets there. And then, well, how fast can the compression be? And only deal with that snare. And then we manage it in that sense. So yeah, it really is a contextual sort of thing. So for producers, it would be actually for embellishment, it can be really cool if you've got a faster release and then it's moving with the music. So you can do that on your mix bus, especially if you're doing like a dance track or something that's got a big 808 and you want it to pump a little bit, speed up the release a bit, you know, nice. Get it moving. And you can be creative with it as well. So because dynamics or rhythmic information is musical.
Yeah.
So it's almost like another component of your arrangement, of your composition, and how you manipulate that's really, really interesting. The sky's the limit, especially with dynamics processes.
Gotcha. Anything that, let's say, because, you know, I'll teach lessons once in a while, and when you talk about, say, upper compression, parallel compression, it's usually something that a lot of people don't really utilize until later in their career. Yeah. If somebody was new to this, what are some of the things that you might suggest? Like the iHeart New York plugin is great for this kind of stuff. I know Inflator does something similar, but if they wanted to kind of like practice at home with it, how would you, everybody's approach to the attack, the release, the ratio and everything for parallel is so different. What are some of the tips that kind of gave you aha moments for that?
So when I was starting with parallel compression, it was using the default compressor, all bust out, manually, like as in like soloing that bus, listening to the compression. And what I'm listening for, is it bringing out the things I want the parallel compression to bring out? So are those low level details coming out? Are those transients getting ducked enough? If it is, then I'm on the right track. And it takes a bit of fiddling because all material's different. So the ratio used on one track will be different to another. Same with the attack and release. But you don't need to go spending money on any fancy plugins when you're trying to learn it, because you really, it's really important to understand the fundamentals and how that interacts with the signal. So you should know how to set up a send, get it into the bus, process that signal, listen to that signal, understand how, when it is actually blended in, what it's doing with the combination of those signals and what's actually happening on a digital signal processing level. So getting started on those fundamentals is what I would advise anybody to do, because it's more exposed. It's uncontrolled. When you're in a plugin, you've got one knob and it's just sort of guiding the show for you. But if you really want to learn and understand what's going on, start from the basics. Whatever you've got in your door will work.
Now, how many times, because I know typically speaking, they'll say like working with linear tools when running in parallel. How much of an issue do you find that in when you're using it in the master?
As long as it's set, like, as long as you've got delay compensation on and everything is sampled aligned, it shouldn't really be an issue. That's the first thing. In terms of linear phase, if you're using something like a multiband compressor, I would only advise one. I know we're not going to be trying to push plugins onto people, but I have to mention it because it's the only one I would use. And the Leapwing Dyne One, the way they've put that together is incredible.
I do like the Leapwing stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, the whole team, they're really great. And yeah, so in terms of linear phase or whatnot, as long as it's sample accurate, if you're going for something really colorful that's going to introduce harmonics, that's obviously going to start to change the shape of the mix quite interestingly. And sometimes that can be really cool or really bad. And it's sort of like a potluck. So my thing is, whatever the default one is, tends to be clean enough. Start there, and then you can broaden your horizons as you get into it more and you start to get a feel for it.
Gotcha. So when does it go wrong?
When does it go wrong?
Yeah.
Well, when does upward compression or parallel not work?
A classic question in the world is always like, how do you know when you're done? How do you know when you've done too much? When it comes to parallel compression and upward compression, what is an obvious sign of like you're going too far with it?
When you're leaning on it. So if you're trying to bring together a mix to bring out things in the background and you're leaning too hard into using the parallel signal, the compressor, you'll start to hear it pumping, like not in a pleasant way behind it. Then you know you've gone too far. Because if you're, like I said at the start, if you're a producer or mixer, always go back to the mix.
Yeah.
As a mastering engineer, if you get a mix in that is spot on, a little bit of limiting, a little bit of EQ, and then you step away and it's spot on where it should be. So you know you're doing too much then. And then it's your responsibility. If you are, you know, guiding through the process of a mastering session or a mastering project, whether it be for your client or for yourself, it's a communication job as well. So it's about going to the producer or the engineer, hey, I've got the mix. I looked over it. I started working on it. However, it might sound a bit better if we do X, Y, Z because your parallel compressor might be pumping everything and working too hard. So knowing when to put the brakes on as well. So yeah, that's very important.
It's super interesting because I feel like the uses of parallel or upward or macro, micro dynamics is different from an individual, even from like a bus level to an individual track level, from like a mastering perspective as well, like uses. Like, for example, have anybody listening right now, you should try doing like hyper fast compression and paralleling that into a drum bus, and then even like EQing it before do the hyper compression and then blending that in, which gives a totally different sound. Like if you scoop out the hyper compressed drum bus, pull out all the mids, so it's mostly just toughened and low, and that makes it really wonky too and cool.
All the sounds of like parallel, like heavy parallel compressed drum loops that I've heard, like all coming into my head, and like I agree, like it put a smile on my face because I know the sound, I feel the sound when you're describing it.
You have to try it. There's also like, I mean, if you in that similar example, I don't think I've ever tried this enough, where like you take a really slow, like let's say just for the sake, like a Fairchild on four, the four time constraint setting. Smashing the drums, that really slow, gluey compression, and then paralleling that totally gives a way different sound as well. And like on vocals, right? So like if you were to do it on just vocals, upward compression is great, but remember, it'll also bring up the small stuff like breaths.
Yeah.
So if maybe breaths will become a little bit too pronounced as well, mm-hmm. So you might want to put at least a gate before, because if you do an aux, sorry, I'm trying to like visualize this for the audience here. If you duplicate a vocal, for example, then you in the inserts you can do gate first or deep breath or whatever first, then smash it so it doesn't increase any breath, mm-hmm. and then blend it in, kind of a deal.
That's you can smart.
Do that
too.
Yeah, I tend to do that. Usually when I'm doing parallel, I'll put a de-esser first. Main reason is because the S has become too much a lot of times because, let's be honest, high frequencies don't need as much volume. So the first thing that's going to get compressed is probably your low end. And then the S's really stand out. So if you do a de-esser, and then I actually kind of like just filtering out just for the range. Like if I'm doing a vocal, I like to filter out a lot and just keep like 300 hertz to like 800 hertz sometimes. And that's all I was looking for out of the parallel compression.
Yeah.
So here's a question, because coming from a mixer, and I want to ask you as a mastering engineer, you've seen lots of different mixes from many different mixers.
Yep.
For the purpose of getting commercially loud, you know, it's a different mindset. If there is an issue, do people, we're talking about macro dynamics, do mixers tend to put in too little dynamic difference between the verse and the chorus, or too much? Has there ever been a session where it's like, oh, it's way too loud in the chorus versus like, you know what I'm saying? Like how often is there a disparity between the two?
Yeah. There's not a trend for one or the other. However, it does happen where two things, the verses are louder than the chorus and that's a headache. Cause then I end up having I put tempo markers in, chop it up, and then starting to have
clip
to
gain automation type thing.
Have to do that. Or it's the other way around where it's really soft, like super soft in the verses and super loud in the choruses. And something really cool you can do for that is with really slow attack, really, really slow release. So super slow attack, super slow release, compressing 12 dB or whatever's the difference is in gain reduction during the choruses. And then if you get your threshold right, it won't do any gain reduction during the verses. So what you have is almost like an automatic leveler. So you can naturally level those verses back out because you're getting a doubling of the signal back in. So you can control that all automatically, and it breathes with the music in a really nice way.
But I will say, anybody listening right now, all y'all mixers right now, do not rely on a super slow attack and release compressor to control dynamics with your verses and chorus or sectional dynamics.
Yeah, yeah.
Like as a mixer, like for me, well, most depending on the song, because like on 24K, a lot of the Bruno Mars songs, the chorus was the soft bit.
Yeah.
But in most songs, the chorus is the loud bit, right? So you get to the chorus, mixer should be paying attention to the dynamics of the verse should be softer, or at least the chorus should hit harder.
Yep.
And if it's not enough, like I've heard lots of mixes where from like rough mixes from producers where it goes from verse to chorus and there's no dynamic difference and it doesn't really feel like a sectional change.
Yeah. Another thing as well is a lot of mixers and producers, I don't know why, volume automation for vocals, they're happy to do. You can automate any parameter in your plugin and you can use it really creatively to create interest. The same way a producer will use a riser or an effect or move things around, you can do the same with the stereo width on a particular element, the amount of distortion you're blending in. You can do that to, you know, when you do have a sort of verse that's a little bit sparse and not keeping up with the energy, you can think, well, what tools do I have here available that's like sort of already dialed in that I might give a little bit more energy or take away a little bit more in the chorus or move between sections? Because most choruses aren't just 16 or 32 bars with the same thing. You know, there's usually turns in them, new elements come in, use it to denote sections where you're giving more energy to the listener. And that those are really cool mixes. But I can tell when somebody sort of like dialed in a mix, set everything up, and there's no automation because it's like the same vocal reverb delay all the way through. And it's like, cool, I get it for the first 8 bars, but...
Especially for like rock music or things where it's like actually recorded rather than like digitized. Because like in hip-hop music, oftentimes it's not weird where the arrangement makes up for the lack of automation. For example, the kick drum in the chorus is actually a different track and a different sample.
Yep.
But like when it's a rock band, the only way to make the chorus louder is either to play louder or turn the faders up. Like that's the only options, right? So and when it's real instrumentation. Or change the total style. Like you go from finger picking to like turn on the overdrive or whatever. Yeah. But like in general, I feel like when there's real live instrumentation, there's a huge, more important need for volume automation.
Yeah.
Especially when the arrangement doesn't create dynamic difference to begin with.
Yeah, that's especially the case because like in a good example for like that playing different at the very least is like electric guitar. If you strum up and down, it feels very different than just straight downstrokes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, like it sounds so aggressive. But at that point, you might want to make that louder if it's the same volume as the up and down strokes.
Yeah.
Just because it's a whole energy difference. And if you don't automate it, it just sounds like static noise that just slightly changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about where we're talking about macro dynamics, I love this topic because this is something, again, we're talking from a mastering engineer's perspective as well. But as mixers, y'all should be making dynamic sections. There was a Mix with the Masters episode that just came out with someone, with a living legend. I forgot whose name it was, who literally had an entire preview click, one of those free preview clips on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Who that's all they talked about. Like when you hit the chorus and you talked about how on his console, if you do like turn up the master bus fader, it actually like compresses more. So you get like just a little bit of gain. I know Warren Hewitt on Produce Like a Pro, he's talked about in Pro Tools, the master bus, if you put any inserts on the master bus, so not like an aux track, but on a master track, if you turn the fader up, then it'll actually compress harder. So it's
feeding in.
Yeah, it's feeding into all the inserts.
Yeah, it's post fader inserts.
Yeah, so which is really interesting. So that's why like when fading out, you might want to use an aux track versus like, because you don't want to compress less as it's fading out.
I mean, depending how the mix worked out.
Yeah, I guess that's fair too.
Yeah.
So, but for you, let's see, are there good examples of engineers that you've seen do it right? Like what is good examples of people doing macro dynamics right?
Macro dynamics, good examples. Tracks that I've enjoyed.
Personal stories that you've really enjoyed.
Man, you know what? Al Bana, anything he's doing, I'm working with him a lot, but he's nailing his mixes. And so that
describe the track for people who haven't listened to it or don't know.
Wish I had my phone on me. I'd give you more of a description. What would be one?
Like what is the emotional, what's happening to you emotionally when you kind of listen to it?
It moves me. You know, when you play a track and then you lose attention because my memory is just at the moment. I'm like dead after NAMM, so like, but anyway, we've all sat in front of our desk, started playing a track. We're like, we are going to listen intently. We're going to sit here and listen intently. A minute 30 comes in and guess what? We're on our phone. Like we've lost, like it's lost us. You know what I mean? Because it wasn't
7 second attention span.
I know. But then there are some songs where you press play and you're like, holy shit. Like, this is capturing me in. I'm enjoying this. Like what Nico was playing last night. One of those tracks, one of the artists, and the track, like I was in the room, everybody's on their phone, and he started playing it. And I'm like, I just got so into it. I'm like, this is a good song. It has energy in the right sections. It's moving me like music should. So it's not like a technical thing where it's like, you must have chorus plus 3 dB verse. -2 dB bridge, -3 dB again. Mm-hmm. It's something that as a listener, it has to take you on a journey, has to make sense. Like you said with the Bruno Mars record, some of the choruses were softer. It made sense. Doesn't make sense for everything, but it has to musically make sense and capture you and keep you interested.
I think this is why I use that Banks song as my monitor check, because there's an artist named Banks who has an album. I don't know what it's called, but the first track on it is just an intro track called Till Now. And the intro track, I think, is the best song in the entire album. And it's not even like an official track, if that makes sense. It's just an intro to the album. But it starts off with just a vocal that repeats once, and then it goes into like vocoder, and it continues layering all the way until the end of the song. It's like these apocalyptic exploding drums that makes you think your speakers are dying, which is a great experience if you haven't experienced that yet. But the greatest thing about it for me is that it just dynamically builds and builds and builds, but it doesn't feel like it's getting much louder.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
What?
No,
both had ideas that we were talking about. So we looked at each other and talked about seven-second attention spans. We're like, don't forget.
No, I did not forget, because everything we've been talking about now is super conceptual. Okay, it's like, well, what are the differences between sections? What are the differences between notes? I actually thought of a really good example people can go listen to. Super good, but it represents good balance of microdynamics, great balance of macrodynamics, like great sectionally. Dugong Jr. is the artist. Voyager is the track. It's on Majestic Casual. It's
Dubom Jr.?
Dugong.
Dugong. Yeah. Ooh, I like that name.
Ooh, can we talk about this?
Yeah.
There's many tracks that I feel like have a very good... Do you find that there's a difference between like a perceived level of microdynamics versus actual? Like, it's actually like metered LUFS is not that different, but like with use of frequencies or whatever, it feels like it's constantly building and it's kind of done on purpose. Or is honestly, like, do you need more, I don't know, more like air space dynamics? Like, is it possible to create perceived dynamics?
Perceived dynamics?
Yeah.
There's ways you can manipulate a signal so it feels like there's more transient information. Like, I've seen one of the questions that have come in, I usually get mixes with excessive amounts of compression. How do you fix excessive compression on a mix? And that would be an example where, ooh, this doesn't have a lot of dynamics to work with. How can we manipulate it? So something like a compansion, where you use a compressor with a slow attack, okay? Slow attack, and then you follow that up. So it's ducking all the body, and then you follow that up with an expander. So you can pull out some of those transient details from a heavily compressed mix. And you can get so far with that. It won't, if something's limited beyond how it's got to sound messy, but if something's over compressed, you can use compansion to do that and you can manipulate what's there.
That's something that for anybody that's interested, you might have to YouTube compansion. So
I think
use
I got a
of
video
compressor.
On it.
You have a video. Okay.
I think I do.
No,
I think I would.
If you have Pro
Tools.
Well,
if you don't, you're going to make one now. You have to.
I will. I will.
If you have Pro Tools, the compressor is literally named comp/expander.
Yep. So you can use one as a compressor, slow attack, then use a second one as an expander.
Honestly, one of my favorite tools for that, actually I have two, but the main one I use is probably Spiff.
Oh, yeah.
Spiff is really good at pulling out transients and not sounding too wild. It can sound wild, but if dialed in right, you can usually get what you're looking for.
I need you to clarify something with Spiff, because a few people have like told me about it. They're like, you should use Spiff instead of like, because I do my thing the way I do it.
Yeah, we all have our own work way. Yeah.
Is it both dynamic and frequency?
Yes.
Okay.
It's cool. Frequency dependent, so you can actually dial it into taste, and you can actually dial in the intensity per frequency.
It's literally the opposite of soothe.
Okay. Okay, like literally, if you inverted soothe,
that's what it means. The inversion of soothe.
Okay. The other one I like, I don't know if you've tried from BOZ, is Transgressor 2.
I've seen you use that one a lot.
Yeah, you can use it like a dual side EQ / transient designer. One side has EQ filters for the transient, and the other side has EQ filters for the release. So you can actually shape the transient frequency dependent and shape the release frequency dependent. So you could add more punch in your low end. Like, let's say the kick drum was a little bit muddy, but there's some transient there. You can boost the transient of a specific area and then cut the sustain of that same area or maybe below it to create a little more punch in the track without having to fully shape the sound of the track.
So I think this is a great time to take a little pause real fast and thank our sponsor. We're so grateful.
For you.
For you, Mr. Sponsor. Thank you so much to to Nick for coming through. But to Isotope, guess what? It came out Monday. Lou and I have had the pre-release a little bit that we weren't allowed to talk about until now. But Neutron 4 just came out for Isotope
it's
as well.
So good.
An updated Neutron. It's very interesting. And they've kind of expanded on the idea of how to mix. It's it's interesting their approach on how they're trying to change the user interface on everything. So something to check out. If you go to isotope.com/MM podcast or mixingmusicpodcast.com/isotope, you'll get either 10% off any of your orders or get, instead of a 7-day trial period, you get a 30-day trial period for any monthly bundles. So this is another, talking about, we were talking about upward compression earlier, but if you reference back to a previous interview we did with Tyler Scott, who is an awesome mixer, you should go back and listen to his episode. He gave us one secret using Isotope and upward or parallel compression. He says, one of the secrets, and he said this is a secret, he almost regretted saying it on the podcast, but I think that we can repeat it because he did say it.
It's in the public
domain. He's
going to
regret it even more now.
Yeah. Is in Ozone Advanced, which includes all of the vintage stuff, he says using the vintage limiter as a parallel in the mix bus phase or the mastering phase sounds amazing, using the vintage limiter, because it's a very slow tube or analog type limiting. And he says he uses that to add dynamics and even automates that for adding extra dynamics into sections for macro dynamics. So I love, as you know, Lou and I love Isotope products.
Oh yeah.
I'm sure that you've used
I love them.
Okay.
His favorite is Master Rebalance. Take those 808s out. No, I'm just kidding.
No, but, so once again, go check out those links that I said before, Rewind, if you want to go back. And yeah, thank you so much, Isotope, for sponsoring the show. But on that note, let's talk a little bit more about microdynamics and what kind of balance between mixing and mastering. But let's start off with mastering. Like, how important is controlling microdynamics from a mastering standpoint?
All right. So from before we get to controlling, it's important for listening.
Ooh.
Because you don't always have to compress.
Can you say that one more time?
You do not always have to
compress.
Louder
for the
community. I don't want to swear.
You can swear. You can do it.
Otherwise,
I'll
start going off my handle.
I'm
just going to start throwing
like
it. No, you don't need to compress. It's not about what do I need to do? It's what do you have to do? So listen, and then go, how do I enjoy this? There are times where mixes come in because the mixing engineer, the producers have been on the same page. They've been doing the right thing by the artist. It comes in and I will not compress it. I just won't. I don't have to. It's good as it is. Why compress it? And why our tools are to change. Why change something that isn't broke? You know? So first listen. Okay. Then you're listening. Now let's get into some scenarios where we're going to go, what would you do? Or how would you approach it? You're listening, okay? I like to monitor quite low when I'm listening for microdynamics. And the reason being is I like to just hear how the transients are interacting with the body. You know, see what's sort of poking out of my speakers, whatnot. Because when everything's cranking, everything's good, okay? Drop it low. Okay, cool. You're listening. Where's the body of the track? You know,
that's actually, okay, hold. That was actually really good advice, turning it down to listen to transients.
Yeah.
Yep.
How low are you talking though? When you do it personally, like you turn to like whisper quiet or
like whisper. I'm just, let's get in the zone together. Okay, okay. All together. We'll get in the zone. Okay. It's going through. All right. You're listening to, let's say there's some drums. Yeah. They're moving around. How are they sitting with the melody? The top line. Yeah. Okay. Top line. Come on.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You're listening to it and the drums are going, come on drums. What are you doing? And then I'm like, oh, can't hear much of the transient in the drums. So I'm going to use a slower attack and get a little bit more snap out of the transient. Good. All right. Nice. Now let's swap it up. Okay. Now let's say the drums are really squashed. So. Okay. What's going on here? All right. So, you know, you've got to be listening. That's what it is. You're listening to the little transients. You're listening to the body. And then you're making decisions based on your compression. And then you hit the mute button. Cool. All right, now we can get back to a serious conversation. But that's what you're doing. You're not going through a compressor and going, oh, I want more punch, I want this. No, you don't know what you want until you actually listen to it properly.
Yeah.
And then you make a decision. So, yeah, I hope that starts to help people. You know,
that was very therapeutic for me. I don't know.
I don't know if I've ever sang on live.
I'm going to make sure. I don't usually spend time editing the dialogue, but I'm going to edit that section really well to make it feel really.
Like, you got. Can you like hard pan us for that one?
Yeah, I think.
You can like put some pads in behind and actually produce a whole like beat for that section.
Braden can master it.
Oh, that was so good. Thank you for that. But there's so many gems out of that, including paying attention. I love like turning the volume down for transients. It's true. If you want to impress your friends with your mixes, the secret is to make it so loud that they can't hear your mix. That's the secret. That'll always impress them.
You know, I always thought like, you know, just use an L1 limiter at like minus 50 threshold.
Holy distort. But for real though, I think that's really important. Is that something that oftentimes, because the one unique thing is I'm a mixer, so I really, I listen to other people's mixes too, but it's been mastered, right?
Okay.
Like you get to listen to a lot more raw mixes.
Yep.
Than I do.
Yep.
How often is micro dynamics an issue, and what are the kind of the most common symptoms?
Okay. So common ones, I'm going to go through them. And then if you want to pick on any ones to dissect.
Let's do it.
Okay. First one, super loud snares. All the time. Just like crack, crack.
Specifically snares.
Snares, like super loud snares. The next one, now this is frequency specific, but people will crank the subs in their kick more than they need to. So you've got this like woof in the transient. It's like, and it's not tight.
Especially if it's like really late, like.
Yeah. And the other one is like overcompressing the vocal. So you like a good forward vocal is nice, but when it's super compressed and there's no difference between softer phrases and louder phrases, as a mastering engineer, that's really jarring and difficult to work with. That's like, because I can't re-automate the vocal. I can't remove any of that compression. So those are probably the three top ones.
Would you rather have overcompressed vocals or undercompressed vocals?
Directly compressed vocals. You know.
There's always a third option. Don't you know that?
No,
touché.
No, because a lot of producers will hear this advice, you know, before you send it off for mastering, you know, boost your snare a bit because it's going to come down, or, you know, add a little bit more to your drums or your vocals because it's going to get squashed back in, or less reverb because it's going to come out. No. If your mastering engineer is giving a shit about the mix coming in, they're going to be level matching it, A-Bing it with their chain, and making sure that whatever your intention is on that mix translates to that master. So you shouldn't be worrying about trying to compensate for them. If something is genuinely an issue and they're concerned about it, they'll flag it with you.
Yep.
This is a huge thing that I talk about. This is mixer should take the song to 100%.
Yes.
Exactly. Like it, do not rely on the mastering engineer to take it to 100%. Like mixer should finish the song. Mastering should take it to 101%. Like, so exactly. You should never, ever rely on the mastering engineer to do anything. There's many times where people want me to master the track.
Yep.
But honestly, how much of a difference and change that they want, it's more like me mixing a two-track. Yep. And that's always really hard because, like, they say, I want more top end. But, like, if it's more than a couple dBs, like, I'm just guessing how much they want, you know? Yep. And you shouldn't be relying on somebody else to guess what you want out of your mix. Like if you're mixing it, you should do everything the way you like it.
And also for anybody working with other people, like mixing for somebody, whatever mix you send out of your studio, if it leaves your studio, you need to be happy with, even if it's mix one, being the mix they decide on. Because there's been times where they hear mix one and they're like, I love it. And then you can't do anything more to that because that's going to get sent off and that's done. So my thing is if anything leaves the studio, it has to be release worthy. Don't send off a mix and be, this kills me. People send off a mix and they're like, oh, here's mix one, but I still have to do X, Y, Z, blah, blah, blah. It's like.
Then do that and then send it to me.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like, actually, you know, I didn't mean to diverge there.
Let's talk about the snare thing real quick. I know that you try to master things without leaving any artifacts. Try to leave it the way it is. But what are some tools that you use to kind of cut down on the sharp transients, the microdynamics, hurting it the least?
Okay. So the best form of limiting is manual limiting. that means dragging, yeah, dragging the isotope audio editor, finding where the true peak is, the loudest true peaks, going into the waveform, like really in, like we're talking 20, 30 samples deep, okay, where you can see the dots of the samples and just clip gaining the channel that it's peaking on and doing it manually like that. There might be 20, 30, 50 points. It might take a little while. And it is so transparent. You can buy yourself 2 decibels of headroom. You won't notice it's going on. You don't have to use as much compression later on and you can crank that shit.
DK is about to go run home right now. He's not even going to upload the podcast.
Are you using, wait, what are you using?
RX Audio Editor. Our sponsors. RX, our sponsors. Come on. Right, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, you're pulling it into like the third party RX?
Yeah, RX Audio Editor, the standalone. You drag it in. You can get your waveform values, find where the peaks are that are just too far out. And then you can zoom all the way in. All the way in. And you can manipulate that just using gain. So it's not using any compression, no attack release. You can just gain the peak. Just you can even
essentially when it's not clipping it's just bringing it down.
Is it quick on RX? Is it faster on RX? Because I'm thinking, like, what's the difference between that versus like going into Pro Tools, zooming in and clip gaining?
Because accuracy
and also sometimes they're like, if I've got a hot mix, there are intersample peaks, so all I want to do is go between sample 500 and something thousand and 500 and something thousand and one, where it's just going over zero accurate. And I can click on the sample, like the individual 1/48 thousandths of a second sample, and just bring that sample point down so I got no more intersample peak there.
Although I will say though, if I got to do that 500 times in a song, you got to be paying me a shit ton of money. Yeah.
Put it this way. If I'm having to do it 500 times a song, I'm better off going back to them going, hey, can you bring that snare drum down a decibel or two?
Fair.
But it's probably, you know, most mixers anywhere from 10 to 50 times I've got to do it, and they'll take me 20 minutes.
I've heard of other people going out to RX for various different things. I've never heard of that usage.
Yeah, it's cool. Especially useful when dealing with like live drums. If you're dealing with like live drums that are like inconsistent sample peaks, it's like, okay, cool. This one hit really, really peaked out, but the rest of them were fine. Yeah,
I've never gone out. I've always just used clip gain and figured it out in that way. Or if I go into,
I've used clip gain before. Like even after that, if I'm like I missed one or whatnot, but I like using RX just because of the amount of resolution in it. It just makes my job.
I've never thought to do that. That's so cool.
You buy yourself a lot of headroom.
Yeah. All right, so let me ask you a fun question, because this has happened to me before, and I know a couple other mastering guys too. You get the V1. End of session mix because they don't have access to the files anymore, but they really want to release that song. You have to master that song. You're almost mixing the master, but there's noise, there's hiss. Analog on H delay was left on. Are you ever trying to remove the noise? I know you're an RX user now. Are you ever trying to use RX for more than that?
So I'll try and remove the noise in the intro, the outro.
Mm-hmm.
Or I try and remove only so much of the noise and maybe sometimes even add extra noise to the top of the tail. Mm-hmm. So the fade in and fade out are longer. Mm-hmm. So when the listener press play, it sort of gradually comes into a point where they don't notice it. Because if you press play and there's noise, straight away people know. Whereas if it's like that, I'm not going to start singing like you guys. I would have cued you guys if I needed to.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. Cool. But yeah, that's how I would be doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've had to use RX for similar reasons. Apparently, one client's car got broken into and his bag was stolen with the hard drive with all the masters and everything ready to send off for mixing and everything. Never made it to mixing. So they just had end of day CD order 1.5 hour long bounce.
Jesus.
Yeah, they apparently like did all the skits, lined them all up, and they're like, okay, great, this is how we want the mixing engineer to do it, so just bounce one long version so we can listen to it in like one playthrough and see if it feels right. But then when the hard drive got stolen, they just had the email of that one bounce for an entire album.
Was it
at least a WAV?
It was an MP3, and I had to do the most.
No.
I know. But I'm not going to lie. The difference I was able to make for it was like I said, mixing the master. It was still a good difference, but holy crap, did it take like hours to find a way to like, okay, this was definitely an end of day bounce. How do I mix a 2-track?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. So not fun.
I think as we come to a close for this episode, I want to talk about the last thing is limiting, specifically with limiting. And okay. we can even talk about clipping. Mixers and producers who often either mix into a limiter or use a limiter afterwards.
Yep.
How do you listen for limiting? Like, how do you, what do you pay attention to when adding limiters to a track?
When I'm adding a limiter to a track, the release time, number one.
And what does that sound like? If you can try to describe that for you.
Like, I don't know how to do, like.
yeah, breathe. Sing it.
Cue. No. You can feel it pump back out. So usually what I, this is, I'll tell you my whole, how I dial in my FabFilter Pro L2. So the attack, I don't want to go too far around, but I just want to get to the point of what I'm listening for. So I'll get through the process. So the attack time on FabFilter Pro L2 is a gate for the clipper. So if the transient is longer than the attack time, the release time is engaged. If the transient is shorter going over the threshold than the attack time, it just clips. It doesn't have a release stage. Mm. What I do is I go, well, how much do I sort of want to bring this up? Is it a decibel, 2 decibel? What am I sort of feeling for? How much more volume do I need in this? And I have the attack set to 0 and the release time arbitrary because that doesn't matter right now. But I get the amount of sort of gain I want to get into it. So that way I know I'm only activating the limiting and the release stage. Then I listen. I dial in the attack to a point where I know, all right, this is feeling good. I mean, I should have said the release. I dial the release to a point where I go, oh, this is feeling good. It's releasing well. It's not too long that, you know, each transient's starting to cut off the next one. It's not too short that it's pumping back into itself. And then I open up the attack time. Now, as I open up the attack time, I'm opening up more transient to start clipping. Okay. Mm. So as I open it up, you can hear it. It's not like audible clipping, like it, but it's a different sort of compression because it's not necessarily looking ahead. It's not engaging that release stage. It's just going straight off the top. You open the attack time to as loud as you want to get it. The more you open it up, the louder the track is going to be because it's just clipping as opposed to limiting. And then just open it up to a point that feels good.
So I did not know that. I did not know that on limiters like the L2 that if you move the attack time, I've always wondered what that was because I use a couple limiters where there's an attack and release time. I understood the release time and the pumping thing. I did not realize moving the attack made it clipping.
Yeah, I did a whole video where I'm like, oh, this is how you use the attack time. And then like a few months later, I'm like, I read an article and then I started doing some tests and running it through and I'm like, and the tests were like little beeps. Okay, and then that's I did the so beeps cool. 50 milliseconds long. Then I set the attack time to 100 milliseconds and the release time wouldn't engage. Mm-hmm. Then I set the attack time to 25 milliseconds and the release time would engage. And I'm like, okay, what's actually going on with the waveforms? I look in, I go, oh, it's soft clipping. And I go, it's a gate. It's a complete gate for that release stage.
Is that specifically L2?
That's specifically L2.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
So what about like,
was
for
it
example,
the Sound on Sound article that you read? Or
sorry?
Was the Sound on Sound the article that you
no,
read?
No, it was... It was another gentleman's name. I can give you guys the name.
I found that info from Sound on Sound, and that's what got me interested in the plugin.
I had to do like actual tests to be like, what's the DSP? What is actually going on in there?
I know the Oxford limiter. I use that often. It has an attack time too. But I've always wondered what that meant because you wouldn't want anything going past it, right? to be like at least theoretically for a limiter, while limiting. But that's so interesting. So you said just to recap, you limit it to a whatever, everything's kind of arbitrary, the settings are at the point until you get like a good dynamic control. And then you move the release first to kind of make sure that it's in time and not too pumpy or whatever. Yep. And then you last thing is you mess with the attack time to balance clipping versus limiting.
Correct. And it was the Jonathan Jeter article.
The Jonathan Jeter article?
Yeah.
Question mark. Thank you so much, Pixel People, for commenting that on the stream. So yeah, you can Google right now the Jonathan Jeter J-E-T-T-E-R article about the L2 and the attack time. That is so interesting. I've never heard of that before. I'm sure that many people will get some good kicks out of that and at least be able to use it. Any other final advice, practical advice or thoughts that you have for mixers and producers?
Watch the podcast every time. Just watch the podcast. Get Isotope. No, you should have Isotope. If you don't have Isotope in... No, I'm not even joking. Not because it's a sponsor, but I'm being serious. You should have it in your toolkit. The RX suite, at a very minimum, should be in your toolkit because whether you're doing vocals, vocal editing, mastering, mixing, it will come in handy. But advice that you can go home right now to start with is start with the basics, start with the fundamentals, understand how your signal flow affects a listener. So this waveform, what is it actually doing and impacting a listener, and how is it doing that? I mean that genuinely, because we can get really technical on stuff, but ultimately it's zeros and ones. It's waveforms that have a million or a billion different permeations that can be possible, and it's how we understand that that will enable us to do better work as we move forward.
Absolutely. So I hope that from listening to this episode, everybody pays a little bit more attention to macro dynamics, the dynamics between sections, and micro dynamics, the little pokey things when you look at a squiggly waveform. But yeah, thank you so much for joining the podcast, Nick. Really, really appreciate your channel, for you coming through on the episode. Again, once again, go check out Panorama Mastering on YouTube. Really, really great information. If you like the stuff that you listened to today, I know that he has a lot more really useful and deep, deep level stuff, deep knowledge stuff, deep cut stuff. So, yeah, I encourage you to subscribe. On that note, if you're listening to the podcast, we, again, do exclusive content. So if you like the podcast and you want three times the amount of episodes, and just like this episode, you want more technical content, more technical tips, you can go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive for $4 a month or $40 a year, so less than the price of a cup of coffee. You can get three times the amount of content. So go ahead and subscribe to that if you'd like. Otherwise, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, leaving a 5-star review does help us get discovered and does help us. We're doing super, super well as far as our analytics goes. We appreciate any sort of help. That small 5 seconds of time helps us out a lot.
And shout out to y'all that came out to us at NAMM.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of people come up to us on NAMM. We had a little get together as well on Friday afternoon.
At the same booth me and you met at.
Oh my gosh. Aww. Yeah, that's right. Lou and I met at the 2019 NAMM in front of the Antares booth. So that was kind of a little celebration. So thank you so much for listening always. And as we always say, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you can't get enough of the Mixing Music Podcast and want three times the amount of episodes every week, subscribe to our exclusive content for only $4 a month or $40 a year at mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. Happy mixing, my friends, and enjoy the show.